You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Martin Indyk, the Director of the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. And I'm delighted to have the opportunity to moderate this conversation with Marvin Kalb about his latest book, The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honoured and Betrayed, the B word. We'll get to the B word soon enough. I think probably you're familiar with Marvin Kalb, but as Henry Kissinger, we were just discussing Henry Kissinger, says he didn't need an introduction, but he liked one, I suspect. You might like one too, Marvin, but you certainly deserve one. Because Marvin, for the last 2 years, has been a guest scholar here in the Foreign Policy Program. And in that period of time, he has made a really wonderful contribution to the collegiality, to the debate within the Foreign Policy Program. He chairs our monthly brown bag on a regular basis. He's a favorite with the younger scholars and non-research staff. And while he's been doing all of that, he's also written two books, which is a kind of record if you weren't sitting next to Mike O'Hanlon.
That's what I'm saying.
But other than Mike O'Hanlon, you probably hold the record. And so it's been an amazingly productive time, and we really are grateful for the role that Marvin has played here, and it's been wonderful to have you. The first book that he wrote here was he wrote in a collaboration with his daughter, Deborah. It was called Haunting Legacy, Vietnam and the American Presidency, from Ford to Obama. Today, we're going to talk about his latest book, which is kind of, in a way, I think, an outgrowth of that book, and focuses very much on American presidential commitments made, both formal and informal, and the impact that that has had on the way in which the United States conducts its foreign policy and its military interventions. I grew up in the umbrella of one of those commitments, that is the ANZUS Treaty. I grew up in Australia, and Australian foreign policy consisted of doing everything possible to ensure that the commitment on paper actually might result in the end in a real commitment in practice. And that meant fighting every war that the United States has ever been in since the treaty was signed. But it, I think, serves to illustrate the point that Marvin will make greater detail in his presentation today about the strange nature of these commitments. And I had the honor to participate in the negotiation of a second commitment that Marvin talks about at the end of his book, which was a U.S.-Israel defense treaty that never came into being. But I therefore have some experience with what he's about to talk about today. And I think it is a rarely studied, rarely talked about part of American foreign policy that Marvin has done a great service to the debate by writing this book. Marvin has a long pedigree that starts in the television journalism business. You probably remember him as a host on Meet the Press for NBC News and its Moscow bureau chief. He was also chief diplomatic correspondent for NBC, and before that, reporter and commentator for CBS News. He was the founding director of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And he has a string of other titles and, to his name as well. He's a great personality that's strutted the stage of U.S. foreign policy for decades. And so we're delighted to have a chance to host this discussion with you. Joining us in the conversation is Michael O'Hanlon. Mike is the Director of Research in the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings. He's a Senior Fellow in the 21st Century Security and Intelligence Center, and he is our resident expert on all things to do with American foreign policy, American strategy, and in particular American defense policy, and lately has been focusing on the defense budget in the age of sequestration. I always have to check what his latest book is, because it's always hard to keep up with. But his most recent one is called Healing the Wounded Giant, Maintaining Military Preeminence While Cutting the Defense Budget. That was just published a month ago and focuses on sequestration. His book before that, I think, was the book he wrote with me, which was called Bending History, Barack Obama's Foreign Policy. And he's just completed another book, which will soon be published with Jim Steinberg, on the U.S.-China defense relationship. So, Mike, thank you for joining us today, and we're delighted to have you as part of this. I'm going to give the floor to Marvin to speak a little bit about the book. Then we'll have a little conversation up here for a bit, and then we'll go to you to bring you into the conversation. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Martin, and thanks to you, Mike, for being here as well, and thanks to you all for joining us. This is a book, The Road to War, that I have at different times been thinking of writing for the last 40 years, ever since I was covering the Vietnam War, most of that time here in Washington. And the question would arise in my mind as to how come the President of the United States, without asking Congress for a declaration of war, could commit 548,000 troops to fight in South Vietnam? And the question, of course, had an immediate answer by those people who thought it was a good idea. And that was that there was the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964. And that was, for anyone who read it, a pat on the back by Congress to a former member, Lyndon Johnson, in effect saying you can use any military means you like in order to defend America's interest in Southeast Asia, which is what Johnson, a copy of which Johnson had been carrying around in his pocket for about a year, waiting for an opportunity for Congress to give him that pat on the back. But it was not a declaration of war, and we should not kid each other into believing that it was in any way. It wasn't. The last time an American president went to Congress to ask for a declaration of war was on December 8, 1941, the day after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. That was something that the president asked and got immediately. There was no argument about it. That was the pattern. If the U.S. was attacked, a president would ask for a declaration of war. That was the fifth time in American history that a president had done that. But since World War II, the United States has been involved in one war after another. A sorry state of affairs, but a fact. And from the very beginning, no president, whether Democratic or Republican, ever thought about the utility of turning to Congress and asking for a declaration. That was something that was simply not done, in part, I suspect, because a declaration of war was regarded as an antique from the past, something that you would not even think about in an age of nuclear weapons, in an age of the Cold War, in an age when you could have a Cuban Missile Crisis bringing the U.S. and the Soviet Union very close to a nuclear exchange. Harry Truman said to close members of Congress in 1945, that if he ever had to commit American force to battle, he would, without doubt, go to Congress and ask permission. In June of 1950, when the North Koreans attacked in South Korea, he did not do that. He went to the UN at the Security Council because of a Russian absence. He got permission from the UN Security Council to send eight American divisions to South Korea to fight in a war which was never ended in a victory or defeat. It was a stalemate. Since that time, tick off the number of wars and tick off the number of times a president did not go in a function of his War Powers Act, did not go to Congress and ask for permission, and you'll find it very many indeed. What has been the net effect of all of this? One is that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, could say 2 weeks ago that he had unbounded powers, quote unquote, in the areas of national security. And he went on to say that he did not think that was very much in the best interest of the country. But he had them and has them, as every single American president has, Democrat or Republican. Now, why is that? There are basically, in my judgment, three reasons, and I've alluded to one. The first and most important reason is that Congress has effectively abrogated its responsibilities in the areas of foreign policy. There are two areas written into the Constitution. One is the declaration of war, and one is the power of the purse. Only once since World War II has Congress used the power of the purse, and that was after the bond doors had been left open. That was in 1973, the War Powers Act, which was, if you read it, one of the weirdest pieces of legislation ever put out by the Congress. It said, in effect, that if the American president wants to go to war, he has to go to Congress to get permission, and he has to agree to a war that would run 60 days, no longer. But if the war ran longer, he would have to go back to Congress to ask for an additional 30 days. And if the war did not end in 90 days, the Congress had no real way of dealing with that problem. And it was, at the end of the day, a rather silly piece of legislation. And only once or twice since that time has the law ever been even looked at in a semi-serious way. And that was a couple of years ago when the president used intelligence and air power in the Libyan encounter. And at that time, a number of senators did go and complain to the White House that the War Powers Act should be used. The president, if he listened at all, ignored them and went and did what he had to do. And it ran longer than 60 and 90 days, but so what? And what I'm getting at here is what former Senator Jim Webb said in a very interesting article in the magazine National Interest. He said, this is almost a direct quote, that Congress has become irrelevant in the conduct and execution of American foreign policy. And he ticks off about seven or eight illustrations where that is the case. So the president has this power in large part not because he wanted the power, but because it was there on the street and he picked it up. Congress didn't do it. The second reason he has this kind of awesome, unbounded power is that we now have an all-volunteer military force. Up until that time, we were dealing with a draft, and when a war went sour, parents would get out and demonstrate. There would be visible signs of popular discontent. With an all-volunteer force, think about what has happened. Think about the percentages here. The all-volunteer force represents 0.6% of the American people. The American people, the rest of them, represent 99.4%. There is a chasm opening up between the two. It's already there and clear. There is not a great deal of understanding. And on the part of the 99.4%, if the war does not touch them directly, they really have very little feeling for the 0.6%. Not a good idea. But it has left the presidents with this additional power that, like the European monarchs of old, he has his own army. He is commander-in-chief, and what he says in this respect goes most of the time. A third reason for the president's rather awesome power has to do with the media. And I speak here as a representative of an old-time media, but I believe in the old time we did a more responsible job than the new guys on the block are doing. Now, I'm sorry to say that, by the way, because there are some marvelous reporters who are still at work. But it is not in the same way, and I don't want to go into a 50-minute speech about why the media has changed, though if you have a question, I'd be happy to address that. The second major part of the road to war has to do with, and Martin has already alluded to this, has to do with the way in which defense treaties play a role in a president's, in the use of a presidential power. The book starts with our experience in the Korean War. It goes on to the Vietnam War, and it ends with a discussion of Israel. With the Korean War, when that war ended, the U.S. and South Korea have reached a mutual defense treaty. It is backed up today by 28,500 American troops based in South Korea. They are there as a tripwire. If the North Koreans were to come across again, the U.S. immediately would become involved in the defense of South Korea. Every year, the leaders of both countries pledge themselves to the treaty, and it has succeeded more or less in the way that the NATO treaty has succeeded. It has kept the peace in that area. It's uneven, it's uneasy, but it's kept the peace. In the Vietnam experience, there was nothing like that at all, because each one of the presidents, as they entered the war, did not go in intending to fight a war. It was an accident. It was a reluctant set of decisions on the part of presidents and their advisors, many of whom hadn't a clue as to what was going on in Vietnam, had no sense of its history, no sense of its religion, no sense of where it might go, its politics. It just was part of the Cold War, and it had to be defended, and ultimately, to the tune of 548,000 American troops, 58,000 of whom never got home. And in Korea, 53,000 never got home. And in Vietnam, we ended up with a humiliating defeat. Now, Israel. The United States and Israel have an excellent relationship, probably as good as the U.S. has with any country around the world. That is a relationship, oddly, given the closeness, that is based essentially on two things. One is a series of private presidential letters that are sent to Israeli prime ministers. They spell out what it is that the U.S. thinks about a particular problem, the one that is on the table at any one time. And there are many such letters. They're fascinating to read. There are also memos of understanding. This is largely a Pentagon kind of thing, where if there are going to be X number of tanks, whatever, planes sent to Israel, you write up a memo of understanding, what they're going to be used for, what the cost is, etc. But there is nothing like a treaty which sets out the rules of the road more or less to be obeyed by both sides. At a minimum, understood by both sides. Now, I happen to think that that's a good idea, but it's not my idea. The idea originated, to the best of my knowledge, in August of 1970, when Senator J. William Fulbright, who was not exactly a great fan of Israel, decided that it would be in the interest of the United States to head off his very dark vision of a U.S.-Soviet collision of interest in the Middle East, and perhaps growing out of that a war, that if the U.S. would put, in effect, its money on the table up front and had a mutual defense treaty with Israel, this would be a fact that would have to be part of the calculation of the Arab world, of the Soviet Union, and, of course, of Israel and the U.S. The State Department pretended it didn't hear the senator, and the Israelis ignored it completely because it violated their sense of independence and what it is that they wanted to do when they wanted to do it. The next time it came up, to the best of my knowledge, was in 1996, when then Prime Minister Shimon Peres raised it with President Clinton in the midst of a negotiation having to do with the Golan Heights, negotiation with Syria. Peres asked Clinton, would the U.S. back us if we have to get off the Golan? Would the U.S. back us with a defense treaty, with a security arrangement that would provide Israel with what they felt was the security guarantee necessary for them to pull off the Golan? And Clinton said yes, if it's part of the deal. If at the end of that kind of deal, if there were, in other words, a deal between Israel and Syria, that the U.S. would then move in with a defense treaty. It came up once again in the year 2000. Martin alluded to that earlier on. At that time, the players were the new Israeli prime minister was Ehud Barak, the Palestinians, not the Syrians, represented by Yasser Arafat, and of course the U.S. with Clinton. At that time, Barak raised the idea, similar to what it is that Peres had done 4 years earlier. If we reach a deal, we Israelis reach a deal with the Palestinians, would you come in with a defense treaty, some security arrangement that would ensure Israeli security, given what it is that Israel territorially would have to give up in a deal? And the president said yes. Two people on the U.S. side were tasked with beginning to draft such a treaty. One of them is seated to my immediate left. The other is upstairs named Bruce Rydell. And they actually began working on this. And it had reached a point, not terribly far, but far enough for a number of lawyers to come in to begin to look at language. Interestingly, the Israelis arrived at Camp David with a draft treaty in their pocket. So they already very much had this in mind. My own feeling in wrapping this up is that nothing that you touch in the Middle East is easy or a piece of cake. Nothing. But if you want to introduce an element that might, at a certain point, in a negotiation between the Israelis and the Palestinians, if you could get to a point where the whole thing is there, and both sides know it, and both sides are on the edge of committing themselves, at that point, a U.S.-Israeli defense treaty would, in my judgment, make a great deal of sense. Who would object to this? Undoubtedly, many, many people in the Arab world. My argument there, and it's a very simple one, it's almost simplistic, is that at this point, most people in the Arab world believe that there already is such a defense treaty. It just hasn't been drafted. And they, you know, it's there. And I'll close with a sort of funny story that I was having lunch a couple of weeks ago with a man who, and I will not give you his name because I don't want to embarrass him, but a man who played a very prominent role in the George W. Bush administration. And I wanted very much to get his take on the idea of a treaty. So I said, Mr. X, what do you think about this? And he said, don't we already have one? And that is part of the deceptive, less than magical quality of this relationship. It is so close you could imagine things. But an Israeli scholar said the other day to me, we live often in the U.S.-Israeli relationship with presumptions, not with facts. We live with presumptions of certain things being in place when they might not actually be in place. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you, Marvin. We'll get to the betrayal part a little later.
Oh, yes.
Okay. We'll come back to that. Let's bring Mike into the conversation and get his reaction to this.
Thanks, Martin, and thanks, Marvin, for the opportunity to be part of this amazing discussion. Your book's fantastic. That was an extremely eloquent presentation of many of the main ideas. I think I'll just begin recognizing as well who's part of this panel, not with the Israel question, but with the authorization on the use of force versus declaration of war issue. And you've raised a lot of very important questions, and there are a number of angles one could take in trying to address the basic recommendation, the basic observation that we haven't been declaring war, and therefore the recommendation that we do something about it because it's become a problem. And what I thought I would do very quickly is just tick through four big conflicts since World War II and just do the counterfactual, wondering whether the conflict might have been modified or averted if we had held ourselves to that standard. And what does that tell us? And so I'm just going to do this very quickly with apologies for the this will be simplistic. Korean War. My guess is that if President Truman had asked the Congress for a declaration of war, he would have gotten one.
Absolutely.
You remember the time better than I do, but I think that's...
Much better than
yeah.
you.
That was a fairly clear case. And the problems in Korea, of course, we had a lot of problems in the Korean War, and you alluded to the huge cost, but a lot of the problems arose well after any declaration of war would have been able to prevent them, because they got into the question of escalation. Now, because you couldn't really have imagined a declaration that would have said, if and when you fight your way back to the 38th parallel and you've got an opportunity to go take it hard to the Koreans and overrun Pyongyang, you better stop because we think that'll get you into more. Declaration of war couldn't have foreseen that. So it wouldn't have really been relevant at preventing what became our main problem down the road. Again, I think in the end I'm persuaded by your argument more than I'm not persuaded. And as you'll see, I think there might have been one or two out of these four cases where it could have made a significant difference for the better. And that's a pretty high batting average in international politics if you have an idea that can make a third or a half of all cases better. So I'm coming around to support for your idea, but I just wanted to run through these in my mind. Vietnam, I think, is the next one. And again, you and your daughter have written so eloquently about this, and you reported so eloquently on this and understand the issue so well. This one's hard for me to figure. I'll just put out the idea on the table. There's a part of me that thinks, on the one hand, maybe President Johnson could have gotten a declaration of war the same way he got the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, given the Cold War spirit of the times. On the other hand, and here's where you've really got me to think a bit more than I had previously, the very phrase declaration of war is a pretty stark concept. And even if members of Congress might have been willing to swallow that, would the whole country really have been willing in 1964 to use that kind of language, which by then would only have been 19 years since World War II ended, and it would have echoed back to our memories of World War II. And there would have been a starkness about requesting that kind of approval that I think might have changed the nature of the debate quite a bit. Would it have kept us out? I don't know. Would I have liked that it keep us out? Yes. I think the Vietnam War was a huge mistake, and it would have been, could have been fought better. But it would not have been plausible that we would have come out in a very good place regardless. So I would have liked to see that, and I think you may be onto something, and I'll look forward to seeing if you want to comment on that. But I think even though Johnson did get this open-ended resolution, it was easy for members of Congress who just wanted to give him the pat on the back, as you described it, to sort of hope for the best, that this was going to be another police action or an incremental use of force with only limited consequences. And therefore, why not? You know, why not go ahead? And in the Cold War, we got to send the Soviets a message, got to send the Chinese a message, so let's go ahead and do this. Whereas a declaration of war, much more stark, and perhaps therefore harder for the country to go along with. Now let's come up to the wars of the last 10 years. And as you well know, and you wrote about in your book, both Iraq and Afghanistan were approved by the Congress in one way or another, and as were a number of our other conflicts. And they were approved in advance. They were not approved only after we had had forces in harm's way for a while, which, of course, has been debated endlessly as whether Congress abdicated its responsibilities by making the wrong decision on either one. But it raises the natural question of would your preferred approach have made a difference? And let me again offer a nuanced answer, and then I'll stop with this opening set of thoughts. On Afghanistan, my guess is that President Bush could have gotten a declaration of war against the Taliban regardless. It was only a few days after 9/11. The Taliban were obviously unwilling to turn over bin Laden. They had been granting him sanctuary. And obviously an extremist regime that we had thought about trying to talk to, sound familiar, but that nonetheless we knew was bad news. And on top of that, they had just facilitated, indirectly at least, the largest loss of life on American soil in a single day in our history from a foreign attack. And so I think we could have gotten a declaration of war. Now let's go to the Iraq debate, and I'll finish on this point, and we all, I'm sure, could have our could play back the history and think through what might have made a difference here. But sort of like with Vietnam, I tend to think that if you had, sitting in the Congress, been required to vote yes or no on a declaration of war against Saddam Hussein and his government, it would have been a different kind of vote and a different debate. Now, admittedly, we all knew what was coming in the fall of 2002. We knew what Congress was being asked to vote for. And any member of Congress who didn't view this as the essential equivalent of a declaration of war, I think, was not being realistic. But there was still hope that we were authorizing President Bush to hold the threat of force against Saddam in a way that would allow the inspection still somehow to work and make the war unnecessary. People could tell themselves that story. If the Iraq War had worked out as a spectacular success, maybe I would have to use that as an example against your proposal, because I think if we had been asked to vote for a declaration of war in the fall of 2002 or early 2003, people might have been more skittish, and maybe they would have voted no. In the end, perhaps they should have. And in any event, your proposal would have forced a much more stark and clear examination of what it would have meant and what it did mean, ultimately, to use force. So I think when I do this little survey in my mind, I'm persuaded that at least for bigger operations, you're right. And the weight of evidence is more on your side than against you. It's a textured, nuanced argument for me. And by the way, one more thing I'll just tee up and leave for discussion later. On conflicts like Kosovo 99, or if we bomb Iran's facilities later this year or next year, would it be a realistic thing to do? Harder question in some ways for me. So I think we have to also think about what kinds of categories of military operations are we discussing, the need for surprise in some cases. So there are a number of other complexities that weigh in, but on balance, consider me largely persuaded by your argument, and thanks for making it.
Let's just press you on that for 1 minute, yep. Mike. Iran, why wouldn't it apply? If the president feels it's necessary to fulfill his commitment to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, why wouldn't it be appropriate to seek a declaration of war, as Marvin argues, the general principle?
Yeah, I haven't. To be honest with you, I was trying to punt. I don't know what I think. I was really trying to say that.
It's kind of obvious.
Well, so you're holding me to it. He's my boss on top of that. That's it. But it's a different category of problem for me when, first of all, the element of surprise would be important in an attack, and secondly, the operation, if it goes well, could be limited. Having said that, I think I probably come around to the Cal position on this too, because the president could actually ask for a resolution, maybe I'm halfway to you, a resolution more like what we gave Bush in 2002 on Iraq, more of an advanced authorization to have this in his hip pocket if he needs it, but one step short of a declaration of war, really to make the threat of force more credible. I don't know if that's going to make you feel any better, but it would give Congress a more serious role in the debate right now.
May I answer your question? No. The way you asked it, you said that the president had made commitments that Iran was not to have a nuclear bomb, and that then would you go to Congress and get a declaration of war and all that stuff. Put that aside for a sec, because with that question you've raised one of the central points that I was trying to make in the book, that we have reached a point now where presidential power is so great that when the president makes a statement, the very fact that the words come out of his mouth become a commitment of the United States and therefore our policy. And when something becomes policy as the direct result of the words coming out of a presidential mouth, lovely though that mouth may be, you've got to be very careful about those words, what they mean, and they ought to be argued out. And I think that our history over the last 50 years would suggest that we fail ourselves when we don't argue these things out. And just because a president says something, that doesn't mean it should be the policy of the U.S. or the right policy of the U.S. And picking up one point, Mike, that you were making earlier, which, forgive me, I've got to correct, I don't have a position. Most of me is still a journalist, although I pretend to be a guest scholar. As a journalist, I really don't have positions. I was trying to lay out the evidence. The evidence is that we haven't done this. And a couple of times, as you so well laid out, it might have made a difference, it might not have made a difference. But one overarching issue is, and you hit it twice, when you go for a declaration of war, that is a stark statement of a total American commitment. The Congress is on board, the President is on board, the people are on board. In the kind of wars that we've been fighting, even though some of them have been very major, and one of them continues to this day, when you don't have that stark, whoops, where are we going kind of statement, presidents can, as we did in Vietnam, slip president by president into a deeper commitment without the country even knowing about it until the casualties begin to rise. As they did in Vietnam, it was only in the tail end of 1967 when casualties rose above 300 a week, and those casualties included members of the middle class. It was not just the poor people fighting on behalf of the United States. And parenthesis, that goes back to this business of 0.6%. Who are that, those 0.6%? And what about the 99.4%? These are different, not only military judgments, but large political and social statements about the kind of country we are and the kind of power that a president currently has.
You know, as you were speaking, I thought that Syria is a perfect example,
yes,
illustration of what you're talking about. I mean, here the president said, you know, it would be a red line, and he got stuck with that, even though he doesn't want to get involved in a war in Syria. He now had to do something about the red line, and so he kind of did the minimum necessary by saying, well, we'll arm the rebels because 150 got killed, not because 95,000 others have been killed, but because 150 were killed by chemical weapons, all because he said those words.
That's right.
But you can't, you know, you seem to be suggesting that, well, perhaps we should give him more leeway with his words.
No.
That won't work.
No.
He's got to be more careful with his words.
Got to be more careful. And unfortunately, we live in a society today where every word is out there. It's available to everybody all over the world. And when a president speaks, as the president spoke yesterday in Berlin, he lays out a policy. Clearly, he and his people have discussed that. And that's perfectly fine. He lays it out. That is now, if the Russians respond, they respond on the basis of what he said in that speech. And again, it could be brilliant. It could be dreadful. I'm only suggesting that the history of this country in terms of war since World War II has led us time and again into conflicts that we don't understand, with losses that are huge, particularly for the families who suffer in these things. And the rest of us go on living our lives barely with a thought to the folks who are out there on the military.
Let's talk a bit about the B word.
Yes.
Which hasn't come up yet, but explain to us where betrayal comes in.
Well, betrayal comes in on the Israeli side in the following way, and it's a marvelous, fascinating story. In 1967, before the 67 Middle East War broke out, the Egyptians moved and once again cut off Israeli access to the Gulf of Aqaba. And the Israelis turned to the United States and said, we may have to do something about this. Will you be on our side? These are my words, not the official words. And this was asked of President Johnson by the Israeli Foreign Minister, Avi Eben, sent by the Israeli Prime Minister, Levi Eshkol. Eshkol was being pressed by his generals to take preemptive action in the Sinai against the Egyptians. Eshkol didn't want to do that. He was very cautious, and he wanted to wait and see what the U.S. would do. So we sent his foreign minister to talk to Johnson. Johnson said to Eban, I'm your buddy. I mean, I think Israel's a great country and I'm behind you all the way, except right now I'm in the middle of the Vietnam War. Things aren't going all that well. And I'm trying to press my Great Society program, and I'm having trouble with that, too. So why don't we go to the UN and have the UN discuss this and come in with a resolution, in a sense, approving of American action in support of Israel on this Gulf of Aqaba business. The Israelis said, wait a sec. In 1957, President Eisenhower gave us a letter saying that the United States will be behind us if this were to happen again, closing the Gulf of Aqaba. So it's right there.
United States will act, not just will be behind us.
Right.
Will act.
And this was a letter written by an American president who was a general and a great hero from World War II. And the Israelis might have exaggerated the importance of the letter or read every word carefully, but they read it in such a way as to suggest that the U.S. is with them 100%. Then they go to Johnson, and Johnson gives them what amounts to a bill of goods. And they felt betrayed by the United States at that time. And that thought of betrayal hangs in the Israeli mind to this day. And I had the privilege, I really feel this as a reporter, to have been able to talk to three Israeli prime ministers, and they, Golda Meir, Menachem Begin, and Yitzhak Rabin. And with all three of them, every time I'd get into this kind of a discussion, they would all, in their own words, say essentially the same thing. They didn't speak about betrayal, but not quite trust. And it's this old Zionist idea that in a pinch, we've got to defend ourselves and trust only ourselves. This sense of betrayal slash trust or lack of trust is simply there. And it's part of the reality of the Israeli diplomatic mindset. And the U.S. ignores this at its peril. And that's what I was saying before about presumption rather than fact and absolute knowledge.
Mike, do you see this in other of our treaty relationships? I'm talking about treaty related. There was no treaty with Israel, but it seems to me that the actual practice of the United States in terms of formal commitments is that we've kept those commitments by and large. Is that right? Yeah.
It's a fascinating question. I think, again, I'm mostly persuaded, and I think that that's mostly correct, but in the part of the world that I've been studying a fair amount lately, Afghanistan, Pakistan, South Asia, we have a couple of interesting counters to this, although I don't think it in any way invalidates your basic argument about Israel, but it's still worth putting this on the table that, well, first of all, part of the world you do know very well, all of our Gulf friends, they're not our allies either, but there can be little doubt that we would come to their defense if they were attacked by Iran, for example, and so there are sometimes very strong commitments in the absence of treaties. But in India, or excuse me, in Pakistan and Afghanistan's case, first with Pakistan, of course, they feel in their narrative that they were attacked. Actually, they started the war generally, but they wound up getting attacked by India. And we didn't come to their aid, even when we did have a treaty with them. And this is one of the betrayals that lurks in the psychology of Pakistanis. As we talk about, you know, future relations and why they're sort of sitting the fence in the war in Afghanistan. So I think actually Pakistan is the exception that proves the rule, to be honest, and that it doesn't turn me away from your argument because there were, first of all, they did start the war with India, the wars, multiple. They may have had, to some extent, a reason, and I don't admire India's handling of the Kashmir issue over the years, but nonetheless, in terms of belligerence, Pakistan started it. And it's about the only big exception of this type that I can think of in the modern era. However, Afghanistan is an interesting point, just to very briefly raise this in the same context. There are Afghans right now who want us to sign a treaty with them. Now, they know they're not going to get it. But some of them are fixated on this, and it sort of is one of the reasons why this bilateral security accord is slow to come to fruition. And what I try to say to Afghan friends is something, first of all, they already know, which is you're not going to get a treaty whether you want it or not. But secondly, there are some kinds of relationships with the United States that are virtually as good as treaties, at least for some cases. Taiwan's situation, where we deliberately broke the treaty, and yet for 30 years thereafter, there was little doubt that if they were blatantly attacked by China, we'd be their friend. Kosovo, which wasn't even a country.
But they do argue about that.
They do. And, well, Taiwan would take whatever they could get from us by way of a clear commitment, no doubt, but they've done pretty well. Kosovo, which wasn't even a country at the time, nonetheless was treated in many ways like an ally in the end. So all of this is just to throw a little bit of gray and a little bit of fuzziness into your argument, but on the way it applies to Israel, provided that there is a peace agreement, and I think the interesting thing for me is when this idea kicks in, before or after a two-state solution, I think it's a pretty intriguing idea.
Just a couple of comments. One, in the view that we had at the time when we were negotiating this with the Israelis, was that we could not do it unless Israel's borders were defined, that it had to be in the context of a solution. Otherwise, what were we defending?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were we going to go to war for Israel's in the West Bank if something happened over the West Bank, mm-hmm. which is the most likely scenario? You couldn't really resolve that mm-hmm. unless you had an agreement. So sure. So when there wasn't an agreement, the whole idea of the peace treaty fell away. But there's a different context in which it has come up, and in fact, Hillary Clinton brought it up in the campaign and raised it again at the beginning of the Obama administration. The idea of a nuclear umbrella for Israel in the context of Iran's efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And that's less a concern about borders and more about trying to pursue a policy of containment against Iran. Now, the president has decided he's not going to contain Iran, so that whole idea has gone out the window.
Right.
But there was certainly a feeling that, you know, there a nuclear commitment might make sense, and you'd come straight back to the question of trust. Because would the Israelis be prepared to trust such a commitment in a context in which Iran had nuclear
mm-hmm.
weapons?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the heart of the matter, in my view. And again, because I grew up in a country that had a treaty with the United States, is a formal ally of the United States, it's in the structure of the relationship between a smaller power and the superpower, the United States, that the smaller power can never be sure that when push comes to shove, treaty or no treaty, the United States will actually be there.
Absolutely.
And so it's inherent in the structure of the relationship that the smaller power is always assuming that a betrayal is coming. And there's not a lot that can be done about that. The treaty in itself doesn't resolve it, and you pointed out in the book, is that the treaty only requires us to go through constitutional processes. It doesn't commit us to a war. And so therefore, as important as those commitments are, it still doesn't really resolve the problem of trust.
It doesn't, and when you speak of the U.S. in this particular case, you're really speaking about the President of the United States. It comes down to the decisions of one man. I was thinking this morning about the situation in 1973, during the 73 war. In the first couple of days, the war started on a Saturday. By Tuesday, Israel was reeling. And Golda Meir called President Nixon and said, we've got to have weapons now. And if Nixon were a different kind of president and thought about Israel in a different way, Nixon thought about it very much as a key ally in the Cold War struggle against the Soviet Union. So from that point of view alone, he brushed aside the internal squabbles between Kissinger and Schlesinger, and said, just get the weapons there. And he didn't care what kind of planes they were flown in on. But supposing it were a different kind of president, the weapons might not have been sent, and there would have been a totally different end to that 73 war. So once again, picking up your point about the crucial importance of trust between essentially one man on the U.S. side and a mindset on the Israeli side.
Or, for that matter, any other the Japanese, for instance, in a dispute over islands with
over
the Chinese.
Over the Senkaku Islands, exactly.
I wanted to ask you both a question about the peace treaty with Israel and ask about the question of American...
You mean the defense
treaty? I'm sorry, defense treaty, and mutual security pact, what have you, and ask you about the importance or the relevance of any American troops that might wind up on the ground in the Levant helping to police a two-state solution, because presumably that's one plausible outcome, that if the Israelis are going to ever accept a two-state solution, somebody's going to have to provide the security for them that their own forces are providing now in the West Bank and Gaza, issues you know much better than I, obviously. And those troops might have to include Americans. Does that make the defense treaty a lot more credible? And does the defense treaty work in the absence of those American boots on the ground?
There were, and I believe still are, American troops in the Sinai. Not many. Very few. And they're there essentially under a U.N. mandate.
No, they're not.
They are not there now?
They're not under a U.N. mandate.
What are they under?
They're under the Multinational Force of Observers. We couldn't get a U.N. mandate for it. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely why the United States is there.
Because you couldn't get
lead.
The U.N.?
Because the U.N. wouldn't do it.
Are the U.N. forces, are the U.S. forces still there?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a small...
It's a very small force.
Yeah. It's run by the United States.
This is something that has been kicked around now for decades. If people at the State Department look ahead, what is it going to look like? Will there have to be U.S. troops on the ground policing a force? I think that every administration I've covered has said no, if at all possible, no. And they would work out some other arrangement. And then they fall back on the Arab League and things of that sort, but it may end up with the Philippines.
The story is complicated. In the case of the Golan Heights deal that you were talking about earlier, in the first National Security Council meeting that Bill Clinton had, the very first, was discussion about whether we would put troops on the Golan Heights in the context of an Israeli-Syrian deal, because that's what we thought we were going to get at the beginning of the Clinton administration. And Colin Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at that point, and he recommended to the president that the only way in which he could see that Israel would be able to withdraw from the Golan Heights is if the United States put a brigade of American soldiers on the Golan Heights as a tripwire.
Wow.
And the president said, if that's what it takes to get the deal, we should do it. And I bet you, he said, the Congress will go along with it. Mm-hmm. And I think he's probably right. So in that context, there was a willingness to actually put troops on the ground up in the Golan Heights. Now, it was a pretty quiet place in those days, but you can see how it can come apart. Now, in the case of the West Bank, the Palestinians would be willing to have American troops there. Abu Mazen has said, you can put NATO troops there. You just can't have Israeli troops there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Israelis say, no way can we have American troops looking after our security in the West Bank. It has to be Israeli troops. So there you go, back to the question of trust.
Yeah.
Let's bring you into it, the good Dr. Shutley.
Thank you very much.
Hang on for the microphone, and please identify yourself.
Pete Shutley, retired from Brookings and State Department. First, I want to compliment you, Marvin, for an interesting book. Let me suggest that there are some advantages to the other argument, which is the ambiguity of not having a declaration of war. Four quick cases. 1940, the undeclared war against Germany, where we were torpedoing, depth-charging German submarines that were attacking British ships, cargo ships. We almost went to war with Germany, no declaration of war, and it gave Franklin Roosevelt a lot of maneuverability to do what he wanted to do. A declaration of war would not have worked. Second, Cambodia, 1970. We could withdraw after attacking. If we'd had a declaration of war, ending our incursion into Cambodia could have been a lot harder. Thirdly, Afghanistan, 79. We fought a proxy war against the Soviet Union using Mujahideen, Pakistanis, etc. Gave the president lots of flexibility by not having a declaration of war. And lastly, Kuwait, 1990, the first Iraq war. Ending that war was much easier without a declaration of war. We didn't have to go go to Baghdad. We didn't have to secure Saddam Hussein's defeat, etc. So my point is, not having a declaration of war, but a resolution of approval from the Congress gives the executive all kinds of maneuver room to end the conflict in all kinds of ways that a declaration of war would impede. One other little point, declarations of war are legal documents when you have a state of war. That means belligerence. What do you do with the country's citizens in the U.S., et cetera, our citizens abroad, their financial accounts in U.S. banks? All of those questions remain open and flexible if you don't have a declaration of war. If you do have a declaration of war, suddenly all kinds of financial laws take effect.
Peter, thank you for the question, and only a good State Department person could have thought of that. I think so. In that first case, for example, with Laos, we had no authority from Congress to move specifically on Laos. The president's moved on that out of desperation, having to do with a particular problem in Vietnam. And they thought by cutting Laos in half and cutting the Ho Chi Minh trails then that they could take care of that problem. They couldn't have. In the others that you mentioned, you speak about the flexibility that the absence of a declaration provides. I can't argue against that. Flexibility is terrific. But flexibility also has led the U.S. into one dreadful, misguided war after another. If you had, to pick up the word of Mike before, the stark statement of a declaration, maybe the Congress, the President, the people would think twice about what it is that they're doing in the commitment of American force. I am only hoping that there is a way to inject more thought, more care into a commitment to send troops abroad to fight. I think it's too easy now, and there's too much power in one man, and I worry about that.
Could I add a point also? Peter, you raise a lot of good cases, although let me challenge you on a couple of them without denying that there's something to your broader point. And I'm not sure we should get to the I'm not sure it's even possible to get to a point where only in the event of a declaration of war can you ever do anything at all with the military. But the 79 case, to me, is not a counterargument to the argument that emerges from Marvin's book. I guess I don't want to blame you for the argument, but one emerges from it to me. And the 79 case is proxy war. It's classic proxy war, and I don't think that's the kind of case you have to worry about a declaration of war. In 1990, I think the first President Bush could have gotten a declaration of war against Saddam for limited purposes.
Absolutely.
And I think he could have gotten the Congress to sign on to the deal that he ultimately came up with. So, you know, you could almost argue if he had to go back to Congress and get its blessing for the deal, and I'm not sure, maybe you could have written the declaration in such a way that he wouldn't have even had to do that. But you could have had an argument that at least some of the, you know, that some of the negotiations we had over the terms of the ceasefire were rushed and regrettable, including the permission for Saddam to use his armed helicopters against the Shia insurgents, for example, and maybe knowing that they had to go to Congress and explain the terms of the ceasefire. I don't want to push the argument too far, but in any event, you could have had a declaration of war, I think, for that particular operation with no trouble, and it would have been a good opportunity to get it back into our DNA that, in general, we should be trying to do this, even if we can't always.
Okay, we're going to go up the front here. Gentleman in blue shirt, and then we'll go to the back.
Hi, my name is Ali Rahnam, and I'm from Arab American Institute. The question I have has a story behind it. I was in a constitutional law class semesters ago, and I'm not originally American. And the first question I asked of the professor was that why do we have a Senate and a House instead of having one parliament? And because I'm originally Iranian, the person next to me said it's not dictatorship as a joke, but the professor told me that American culture wants the changes into important stuff to come slowly. That was the reason that he thought that the founders created two places instead of just one parliament. It wasn't just because of the numbers, because they could mathematically make it happen in one parliament too. But then I thought about the declaration of war, And here, what I see is the one man can decide to deploy a troop, deploy a troop to other country and start a war. And it's easy for us to sit here and say, well, what will happen if America wants to attack Iran? What if they have to go through the Congress to get the declaration of war? A president can easily just say go and hit some targets. I think that the right thing is that, in my opinion, we don't need one person to rush into this such a decision that might happen to be a bad decision, has a bad effect. When we have the declaration of war in place, there is more thought, there is more responsibility. Declaration of war, to me, is not a legal document. It's an action of having responsibility.
And I think you are, in your way, I think you're backing up a central point that I was trying to make, and I thank you.
Yes, please, down the back.
Brian Hallett, University of Hawaii. I'd like to pick up on Michael's counterfactual on Vietnam. He started with Vietnam or with Johnson, and you know, could Johnson have gone and gotten a declaration of war? That case becomes very interesting if you begin with Truman and then move to Eisenhower and then to Kennedy and Ed Johnson. So in June of 1950, when Korea was invaded, Truman doubled down on the French war in Indochina. And it was the first time the American government had made an explicit support for the French effort to reconquest Vietnam. So which is essentially we became allies in a financial sense. So if Truman had gotten a declaration of war for the French Indochina War, and then Eisenhower, and then, you know, Kennedy, it probably would have made a difference before the quagmire became, you know, very mired. So I think that case is much more interesting if you push it back.
I totally agree with you that it is interesting, but you know this area very well. Starting with Truman, we were dealing then not with an American war. With Truman, we were dealing with much more the fear of an American president that a Soviet leader would be moving westward and taking over all of Western Europe. He was trying to make nice to the French. He didn't like the idea of the French going back into Indochina. He had made that perfectly clear. But the French did it anyway. And we ended up, for reasons relating to Truman's fear about Stalin and the Soviet Union, then we began to send, in a very small way, first money, then arms, to the French. And it led on and on.
Up the front here, Gary Mitchell.
Thanks very much. Marvin, your book raises, and this discussion raises, a variety of interesting questions that are not directly discussed in the book, but come out of it. We've touched on both of them, but I want to come at it this way. Given the sort of ubiquity factor with respect to media and Twitter and Facebook and all the other things, one of the questions it seems to me we deal with that we are facing today in a more serious way than in the past is what factors exist to sort of countermand or counterbalance the presidential
authority.
The redlining, the red line kind of factor, or the speech yesterday in Berlin, where the minute that it's said, it's repeated and repeated and repeated, and somehow sort of becomes policy. The second, and to me, the more interesting question is the one that Mike suggests about the power and the gravity of a declaration of war. And given the fact that this 99.4 versus 0.6, it seems to me there's a question I'd be interested in yours and your co-panelists' reaction to the question of whether it is possible anymore, given this gulf, to take the country to war.
My answer is that it is not only possible, but it's too easy to take the country into a war. I could imagine that tomorrow morning...
I understand that. I think the question is whether, given this gulf, whether a declaration of war has this gravity
right.
that Mike has talked about.
Yes, a declaration of war certainly does. And I think that it would be amplified in its starkness by the ubiquity of the message, because given the nature of the media today, it would be all over instantaneously. And people would have to, there are two things certainly possible. One is that you simply accept it. The president said it, the Congress has ruled on it, let's go. But the challenge has to be obvious as well. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was obvious. 9/11 was obvious, but as Mike was saying before, this was something that President Bush chose not to ask for a declaration, but he would have got it instantly. The country was ready to do anything that President Bush wanted us to do at that point in history. We were attacked. That's what makes this, I think, so interesting, that if it triggers an appreciation of the gravity of the moment, then something like a declaration of war makes a great deal of sense, and it would be a unifying force for the entire nation. In the absence of a declaration, with even a resolution of congressional support, what does that mean exactly? It's a pat on the back. It has none of the starkness nor meaning nor gravity of the moment. Everything relates, in my judgment, to the nature of the threat to American interest and the way it is being portrayed to the people.
Okay, let's go right at the back there. Yes, please.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. Peter Boyce. My question to you, sir, your book has been in the process, you said, for 40 years. Why 2013? Why at this point in juncture is this book being published?
I think it's because I'm getting to be an old man. No, but a serious answer is that if you take a look at Horning Legacy, this issue of presidential power, using the illustration of the Vietnam War, has been with me. It's part of my life. I've spent so much of my life covering that war. It's what I try to avoid. You know, it's a little bit like a plague. When you see something rising up on the horizon that smells and looks like something we've already gone through in a very negative way, you want to say, hey, let's wake up.
All the way at the back.
Stuart Sloan, the American Jewish International Relations Institute. My question, Marvin, is could you discuss whether or not UN resolutions act as proxies for declarations of war? I'm looking at the Korean example, and how would that impact your thinking?
Well, obviously it's different. And it, again, depends, and answers sort of to Gary's question. It very much depends, in my judgment, on the threat, on the issue. How does this affect us as a nation? And if the answer to that kind of question is obvious and it's frightening, you could go with the declaration. Short of that, it's probably a waste of time and counterproductive. In other words, I'm not giving you an answer that fits every hole in the ground. I think that each one has to be examined.
Lots of questions, and we only have a few moments to So I'm going to take a few together, and then we'll have to call it quits. So working from the back forward, yes, the lady in the green jacket.
Thank you. Miriam Krieger, I'm a captain in the U.S. Air Force. I have two quick questions for you. One, if you could maybe elucidate us a little bit on why you think Congress has abrogated or perhaps abdicated their role in foreign policy. And two, I agree with the idea that many of these constraints Congress has put on the executive as being sort of odd and glass half full, glass half empty. For example, war powers, you could say that it constrains executive power, but you could also say that it allows the president to wage an unfettered war for 60 to 90 days. In the era of high tech and remote warfare and small footprint operations, how important is congressional use or constraint on the executive?
Okay. Just hold there. We're going to take a few more questions. Yes, right next to her.
Thanks. I'm Jeffrey Lim from Senator Angus King's office. And my question essentially is that, well, given that you've stated that Congress has seemingly abrogated much of its responsibility on the both the declaration and the oversight part of in the process leading up to war, my question is, what can Congress do to sort of anticipate the situation along the lines of more investigations, so I'm not sure that you need them, and also just being more involved in foreign policy, I guess. What specific steps could they take, I mean?
And this one here, young man.
Amala from Jordan, and thanks for a great discussion. So I keep a blog, and I contribute to some other blogs, so I'm, in a sense, part of this new media. And I want to ask you, about the difference between new and old media in terms of checking the power of the president when it comes to declaring wars. Thank you.
I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off there because we won't have time for the answer.
I'll try to be as brief as I can. Why is Congress allowing this to happen? One word, laziness, another word, fear. And if what I am told right now is that Congress people have to spend between 40% and 70% of every day raising money. If that is accurate, when in the day do they have time to consider minor things like war and peace? It's very difficult. And the idea about these short wars and what role is Congress in that? If the war is short, it's going to fit into the time frame of the War Powers Act. So technically, you don't even have to worry about that. But it would be up to the president to determine whether this could lead to a long war involving boots on the ground in a significant way. And then in an honest moment, he is the one who's going to have to decide whether it is worth a declaration of war, a congressional resolution, or just do what you have to do and then argue post facto that I had to go after the bad guys, and if I had tipped them off in advance, we would not have been able to get them. In the current world situation, I imagine that does come up often. On the Congress, I think I've sort of addressed that. On the issue of the media and the new media, it is so incredibly messed up at this point that I have no way of understanding. I really don't. I've thought about this a lot.
You're being tweeted now. So.
Oh, I'm sure. The problem here is that so much is available instantaneously. When do you have time to think about what you're saying? That is the key question for me. In the old days, when it wasn't so immediate, the bad thing was it wasn't immediate. The good thing was you could think about what you were saying. Today, it's rare that you do. And that is my problem with the new media, but I bow before its inevitability.
Mike?
I'll add a brief word. On the media issue, I guess one thing, I share your concerns, Marvin, but one thing I would say, and I'd be curious how some of the younger folk in the room react to this. Peter Singer did a great study here with some colleagues a couple of years ago and pointed out that basically the young generation is smart enough to know that a tweet does not equal serious news. and that a lot of the stuff that's out there in the ether is not really to be taken seriously. And when you ask younger people where they go for serious news, quite often it is CNN or Time Magazine or the New York Times.
But Jon Stewart.
Well, even there,
no, seriously.
No, but even there, there was a mixed result in terms people look to Jon Stewart to sort of keep them abreast of which issues are hot. I think they know they're also watching a guy who's using that material to make a joke. And so I guess one thing is to say there have always been problems in how people consume their news. And frankly, when I look back on Vietnam, one thing I'm struck by is even though the journalism was excellent, that the country didn't have as vigorous of a debate on this, and Washington didn't have as vigorous of a debate on this war for several years as it should have, for whatever reason. So I'm going to stay hopeful about social media, new media, not necessarily cluttering up the airwaves so much. And just one other point in response to the captain's question about whether the War Powers Act, in a sense, is almost too lenient and has too long of a time horizon, I would say yes, and I'll go back to the point that Martin pressed me on at the beginning. We probably, and that Marvin also brought up, we probably should have a debate now in the Congress about whether using military force against Iran would be appropriate. And maybe that debate can actually empower the president if it turns out in one direction. Maybe it'll hold us back in a from getting into a war we may not want if it goes in a different direction. Either way, you've made me think a little more seriously about that question, like many others.
Thank you. And that's why we have Marvin here as a guest scholar, because he makes us think. and that's why you should read this book, because The Road to War will make you think, just as it has in this discussion today. So go out, buy a copy. Marvin, I think, will sign it for you.
With the greatest of pleasure.
And thank you again, Marvin and Mike, for...
Thank you.
Thank you.